The power of the media is great and growing. It has a very close relationship with politicians, I think a slightly incestuous one, each trying to influence the other, and it is a struggle for power. You see, wealth and power are indivisible. In the old days it was land and factories, but now it is really the control of information that is the greatest power that the wealthy have.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Are we being dragged into a war in Syria or with Syria? Or I suppose you could say even for Syria. As the mainstream media broadcasts and prints wall-to-wall reasons to bomb Syria and shows pictures of RAF jets against the sunset rather than the devastation below, we look at the veil, behind the veil, of this post-9/11 neocon era. Well, what do we see? We see NATO's unending wars and the balkanisation of the Middle East, hearing from some of the neocons behind it all later. And we ask, while many of the fighters were trained next door in Jordan, why has ISIS not been attacking their supposed mortal enemy, Israel? Putin is welcoming Britain's support in Syria, but will Russia and NATO ultimately end up fighting over control of Syria and Syria's oil? And claims of 70,000 moderate rebels ready to fight on the ground in support of the RAF and American Air Force. Last we heard there were only 70. Where did the extra 70,000 come from? Can we rely on the source of this information? Who is the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee? Plus, closer to home, what is Bristol's own Stop the War group? Our city's so-called terrorist sympathisers, what are they planning? And to ask that very question, I'm joined in the studio by Jim from Bristol Stop the War. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there. Nice for you to have me on the show.
Jim, tell us a bit about what you're planning, what your reaction has been here in the city.
Well, following the 2,000-strong demonstration on Wednesday night, which went on to a blockade that lasted till at least 8 o'clock when I left, we're going to have a stall in Broadmead, at Tesco Broadmead, this Saturday. That will start out as a stall, but hopefully, if there's enough people, we'll do some action, a demonstration or a rally.
Now, you've lost the argument, though, so why don't you just go home?
Well, can I just announce another two actions? So, following on from that, on Wednesday, a group of six former school children have carried out an initiative which will be a 5:30 p.m. demo on Wednesday at the Fountains. So we hope thousands of people will turn out to show that they don't believe the government's fantasy stories. And of course, I'm also going to announce the Saturday week event in London, which London and Britain's Stop the War group have called in national demonstration, and you can find out more on the website.
Yeah, I noticed there was a big demonstration on Wednesday, wasn't there, outside the Houses of Parliament. Not a lot of coverage directly from there. One of the other things I noticed just driving on Wednesday evening is Radio Wales, which I know the Welsh often get very het up about things like this, particularly as they're quite, shall we say, there was a certain rivalry across the Severn. And lo and behold, the BBC Radio Wales's phone lines were all out, so they couldn't have any people phoning in expressing their views all evening on Wednesday over in Wales. But what are your thoughts about the whole vote, Jim? Because ultimately what's happened here is you've just been voted out, haven't you? I'm afraid there is going to be bombing of Syria.
Well, that's true, but at least half the population of the country aren't convinced, particularly by Cameron's fantasy army, which rivals the Chinese terracotta army in its mystery. And I think that people are very worried about this strategy. Is it simply bungling? Are they incompetent? Or are they just preparing the ground for, literally, for ground troops to go in at some further time and do what they want to do, which is regime change against Assad?
Now, this number of 70,000 does sound a little bit familiar, doesn't it? It's almost like back in 2003, we were told 45 minutes Saddam could be launching chemical, biological weapon attacks.
Well, with so many millions of Syrians leaving the country, isn't it likely the most moderate Syrians are on their way out of the country, leaving only those prepared to take up arms against the Assad regime? You may or may not like it, but they're unlikely to be moderate people.
Or some of them for the Assad regime.
For the Assad regime.
Because because there's a conscription now right across Syria, has been for quite a while. What is your main reason why you think that this is the wrong thing to do then, Jim?
Well, into a very complicated situation, we're just adding our tuppence worth of bombing without a clear strategy, precluding a real look at economic and other political actions that could be carried out. There's not been much attempt to cut off ISIS's wealth and its sale of oil, clearly via Turkey, which the Russians have pointed out. Now, why isn't that the main thing? This gang can't continue its rampaging without an awful lot of money and armaments. They're being backed by Turkey surreptitiously. Why aren't we closing the border at Turkey? They've got enough troops in NATO to do that, and that could just involve beefing up the border at Turkey.
Now, back in September, I was listening to the Iranian president saying, well, the American satellites, surely they can see see the newsprint that you're reading if you're sitting in a park reading a newspaper, and they can see the number plate on your car from their satellite. How come they can't see these oil transactions going on? Like, how come they can't spot those? And they've been bombing for nearly a year.
They can spot them, but what they're claiming is that they're civilian targets and therefore they're out of combat. Now, this is clearly absurd. They've been bombing civilian targets for decades, so all of a sudden they can't identify ISIS and their oil pipeline, their oil transit. And it's clearly some very dubious politics going on behind the scene, identified most obviously by the Russians after their aircraft was downed. And it just really shows that the whole coalition strategy is based on not just a fantasy strategy militarily, but also very dubious politically.
But you seem to be implying that what the Russians have been doing is the right thing, and yet we're going to be joining the Russians in bombing ISIS.
Well,
they've been doing that for several couple of months now.
We can't avoid the idea that different people are in Stop the War. It's a broad coalition. Some people support what Russia's doing, other people are very dubious about it. The fact is, however, is that the Russians have been invited in by the Syrian government, giving it some legality. We haven't been invited in by anyone. We're just blundering.
But whole areas of northern Syria are really now denied to the Syrian government. They're not really part of Syria in any practical sense, are they?
Not practically, no. But are we helping to broker an agreement? We had an agreement possibility raised by Russia 2 years ago, I think it was, and it was just dismissed out of hand by the West. And now things have got so bad, we're going to go in, blunder in again, and continue bombing. How does that help?
Now, before we hear from Martin on this, let's go back to Wednesday again to the debate in the House of Commons. And Angus Robertson, who's the leader of the SNP, Scottish National Party, in Westminster, brought up the thorny issue you mentioned there, Jim, of this 70,000 moderate rebels which are going to help us. And you can also hear he allows here interventions both from the chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, which involves ordinary MPs. Let's just make it clear that you've got two main intelligence committees, the Joint Intelligence Committee, who were the ones that came out with the claim of 70,000 moderate rebels, and you've also got the Intelligence and Security Committee, which is made up of MPs. The Joint Intelligence Committee is mainly civil servants, like the head of the Ministry of Defence, the head of MI5, MI6, GCHQ, etc., and is extremely secretive, but we're only allowed to know the name of the guy who's the chairman of it. A lot of the other members of it, I had a look on the government's website. You're not even allowed to know who they are. So there are these two tiers, really. One is slightly more open to ordinary MPs. And Dominic Grieve is the chairman of that Intelligence and Security Committee. And also we hear an intervention in Angus Robertson's speech, also from Yasmin Qureshi, who's on the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. So let's have a listen to that excerpt from the debate now.
If my esteemed colleague, the Chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, is able to answer the question, I would be delighted.
What interests me about the argument that the Right Honourable Gentleman is putting forward is he raises perfectly legitimate questions, which should, I hope, be answered in the course of the debate.
Yes.
But what he glosses over is what his and his party's position is on the current operations, which I think he will agree with me, are in fact controlling Daesh's ability to do violence and cruelty in the area and terrorism in Europe.
It's a fair question.
And if indeed those actions at the moment involving our allies both in Syria and Iraq are achieving that goal, I find it very difficult to understand how he can argue that we ourselves should not cooperate in northern Syria.
I have the greatest respect for the Right Honourable Gentleman, and he makes good points, and I will come on later in my comments to some of the questions that he makes. But I just note respectfully, again, that we haven't heard an answer to the question which I have posed, and from the government front bench, you have the opportunity, again, if they wish, to tell
the
House.
This is about the 70,000 moderate rebels.
So I will make some... If the Honourable Gentleman can answer the question, I'd be delighted.
I thank the Right Honourable Gentleman for giving way. As member of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, part of the committee, I was in the Middle East last week. We went to Cairo, we went to Amman, and we went to Beirut, cities which has also suffered destruction. Yes. We spoke to military people, counter-terrorism people, the politicians. The answer that you seek, I can tell you how many people there are. It's about 10 to 15,000, and that was the answer given by everyone there.
Goodness, Mr. Speaker, that's a very, very important intervention from the Honourable Lady.
Yeah.
So from her experience and having travelled the region, she is suggesting that the government's figures that we have been provided are massively wrong.
So that's those figures were provided by John Day, J-O-N, John Day, who's the chairman of the joint, I lose count of these committees, the Joint Intelligence Committee, Martin.
Well, I think this is the big Achilles heel of this whole thing, isn't it? In actual fact, we have been supporting rebels, if we want to call them that, inside Syria. Some would call them terrorists. The Free Syrian Army, for example, who are the so-called moderates, they were the people that ripped out the Syrian soldier's liver and ate it on camera in order to intimidate the locals. The Free Syrian Army also, many of whom are actually not Syrian at all, like Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who was of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, they were assassinating people who were postal workers because they were working for the evil government of Assad. These are the moderates that are going to be supported and have been supported by our own intelligence services and special forces.
Well, let's have a look at this slightly shadowy guy, John Day, who's put his name to this figure of 70,000. He was appointed chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee at the Cabinet Office in March 2012. Prior to his appointment, he was the second permanent secretary at the Ministry of Defence, basically MOD's top civil servant. His other career highlights are Director General of Ministry of Defence Security Policy, leading on NATO nuclear and security policy. He's also MOD Director Operational Policy, dealing with Iraq and Afghanistan, Chief of Staff to Lord Robertson, the NATO Secretary General, Chief of the Joint Intelligence Committee Assessment Staff, also MOD Director of Defence Policy, and NATO Head of Force Planning, actually at NATO, Martin.
Yes, well, I mean, NATO is a very interesting organisation because the Italian police investigated NATO in the 70s and the 80s and came to the very firm conclusion, as the head of the Supreme Court in Bozzimato made clear, that NATO were, in fact, people as an organisation involved in committing acts of terrorism and organising people to commit those acts, both fascist and so-called left-wing terrorists.
But with such a glowing, glorious career, how can he get this so wrong? We've heard from on the ground 15,000, and yet he's saying 70,000.
Well, whatever we're talking about, they call them moderates, and the point I was making is there are hardly any moderates in the opposition in Syria. As Jim was pointing out earlier, those who take up arms against the government of their country are not necessarily to be classed as moderates. And if, for example, the oppressed Muslims of Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which was the elected government of Egypt, were to take up arms against the Egyptian government, would that be justifiable? Some would say yes, some would say no, but many would accuse them of being terrorists. If there were moderates in Syria who were opposed to the in Saudi Arabia, who were opposed to that country's completely illegal invasion of Yemen or the invasion of Bahrain was to take up arms, would they be moderates or would they be terrorists? And the other point I would also make in relation to what the British government decided to do on Wednesday and the British Parliament agreed with is it's got no basis in international law. All the legal opinions I've been reading suggest that there is no legal basis for what's going on.
Well, there is, because they've been to the UN Security Council who have passed a resolution saying all means necessary.
No, no.
Now, don't tell me that doesn't mean...
No, that's a misinterpretation. The UN Security Council said that everybody should cooperate together to fight ISIS, but in actual fact, the reason the Russians agreed to it was because in principle that meant that the Syrians should decide who is and who is not part of their coalition to take on ISIS. Now, I see the politics of what has happened is that the Russians have decided to say, thank you very much, Britain, for bombing ISIS. You're joining our coalition. But in actual fact, the official position of the Syrian government is that no foreign planes should be in Syrian airspace. And since we've had a situation where the Turks have shot down a Russian fighter bomber, what will happen further down the line, for example, if the Russians decide, if we try to remove Assad? This is what's going on behind the scenes here. ISIS is being used as a cat's paw to get a coalition together to go and try and overthrow Assad in a situation which is no longer viable. And of course the Russians and the Kurdish militia forces are closing down ISIS's supply line, which is actually being held by Turkmen based groups who are not in fact from inside Syria. The guy who claimed to have killed the Russian pilot is actually a Turkish national, and he's actually a member of the Grey Wolves, which are a right wing terrorist group which has killed hundreds of people in Turkey. And people in Turkey know that this is how the world works. Middle class Britons, many of them in the Houses of Parliament, are basically ignoramuses when it comes to talking about a lot of this stuff. I mean, this frankly is fantasy stuff. I mean, Stephen Fry was saying, and there are 70,000 moderate rebels made up of the Ents, the dwarves, and the Riders of Rohan, you know.
Before we go back to hear from Jim from Stop the War, let's go back to the debate on Wednesday and hear from a local MP for North Somerset, Liam Fox, a short clip from his speech.
We have not chosen this conflict, but we cannot ignore it. Yeah, yeah. To do nothing is a policy position which will have its own consequences. Mm. If we do act, it doesn't mean we will not see a terrorist atrocity in this country, but if we do not tackle Daesh at source over there, there will be an increasing risk that we have to face the consequences over here.
Well, he's talking, that's Liam Fox there, Conservative, who voted for the motion, about tackling this at its source. It's no good trying to deal with the consequences, Jim. We've got to get to the root of the problem.
Well, the root of the problem has been there for several years, where we know that Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Turkey have been funding ISIS. Turkey's quite was for some time, until it was pointed out on the international field, quite happy for ISIS to exist. It helps it for its spurious Turkish empire that it fancies itself having. We know that ISIS has got links to the CIA. We know a lot of things. What's really disturbing is that more people are going to be bombed and killed while fantasy politics is played out, and deeply disturbing spy games are being played for, as Martin's pointed out, for missions that will creep into regime change and other projects like smashing up any opposition to the United States' world domination.
Well, the Labour veteran Labour MP and former Minister Gerald Kaufman also had some words for the discussion and debate, and here's his part, anyway, of his contribution on Wednesday.
If what the government were proposing today would in any way not simply or not totally get rid of Daesh, but weaken them in a significant way so that they would not go on behaving in the abominable fashion that we see, I wouldn't have any difficulty in voting for this motion today. But there is absolutely no evidence of any kind that bombing Daesh, that bombing Raqqa, will result in an upsurge of other people in the region to get rid of them.
Well, that's common sense, isn't it? There are two levels on which this is being... There's people who are saying, well, if this was a viable strategy, I might be inclined to support it. My position, as I've made clear in this programme, is that in actual fact, Britain has been intervening in Syria all along by supporting an armed overthrow of a sovereign state. And that in actual fact, it's quite possible that when the historians come to write about this in the future, they will see the conspiracy between Saudi Arabia and the West to overthrow Assad as the source of the hundreds of thousands of deaths and the millions of displaced people. And I think the only thing we can do, having devastated Iraq, devastated Libya and devastated Syria, is to go home and think about our sins, or rather our leaders should do so. Ordinary people are being bamboozled here.
Also, another voice was that of Nadeem Sahawi, who's a Conservative MP.
Daesh are the death that is stretching from the east. When you see them, it is as if you are seeing the angel of death. They're in Raqqa right now. How can I carry on exposing my child to severed heads and hanging bodies on a daily basis? A mother in Raqqa.
Well, this is just emotional blackmail. In actual fact, there were several Tory MPs who voted against, seven Tory MPs who voted against, and eight Liberals and Democrats who voted in favour. But overwhelmingly, all Scottish MPs, bar two, voted against. And I imagine that if we actually analysed the results from Wales, we'd find a similar result.
But you're saying blackmail. Actually, I hate to point it out, but Nadeem is actually born in Baghdad. He's Iraqi. Who are you
to
tell him?
The Iraqi, interesting, funny you should mention that, because the elected Iraqi government have made it absolutely clear that they don't want any further intervention by Britain and America in Iraq. And they've actually said that they do want the Russians to come into Iraq and help them fight ISIS, but that they don't want the French and the British and the Americans, because they think that they're ISIS's allies. We should have been told that. The MPs ought to know it. But that's the reality, is that the elected Iraqi government is actually quite hostile to our intervention. And in fact, they recognise, because they're on the receiving end, I mean, things like what happened in Paris happen every day in Baghdad. And that's the reality of what's going on. And we've forgotten all about it. It's been going on day in, day out, since Tony Blair made his absurd decision to invade Iraq in 2003.
Yeah, but it's almost as if you haven't noticed that there have been attacks on Paris, Martin.
Well, I have noticed that there have been attacks on Paris. There was an attack the day before in Beirut that killed 40 or 50 Shia, mostly Shia civilians.
And so you
but
think
we didn't even hear about
we should
that,
should sit here twiddling our thumbs, do you think?
No, we shouldn't sit here twiddling our thumbs. I'm in favour of going to war. I'm not a pacifist, but we're going to have to go to war with Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Let's cut off the head of the snake. Let's support those in Saudi Arabia who want to take up arms against that government. Let's do that, shall we? And let's get some car bombs going. Let's be really serious about getting on. We've got to overthrow all of these regimes in the Middle East. The people have got to get into the streets. We've got to arm them up, and then the RAF will come in, as in Libya, and support, give close ground support as these people fight. Is that what we're talking about? No, we're not.
Getting down to Syria specifically, though, what are your thoughts about whether this is going to get a bit of mission creep? A lot of people are saying that they think that's where it's going, towards actual regime change in Syria, which is part of Wesley Clark's announcement. announcement just after 9/11. He said that, that there were seven countries that the US was going to have regime change in, overthrow the governments in 5 years, and Syria and Iran as well are on that list. Do you think we could be going into a mission creep where we start to be part of the moderate Syriac rebels fighting and trying to oust Assad from Damascus? This is, I mean, because the headlines have been about having or getting involved in a war in Syria, but what about a war against Syria, and what about a war for Syria?
Well, if you think back to the last time Cameron came to the House of Commons and said, you've got to support us to bomb Syria, he was talking about bombing Assad, supposedly because of his chemical weapons attack at Ghouta on his own people. Although all the evidence since then, I wonder how many Labour MPs have read Seymour Hersh's article in the London Review of Books, which comprehensively proves that the sarin came from Libya, was supplied by MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, and was used as a mechanism to try and trick. So NATO itself was responsible for the death.
It wasn't just Seymour Hersh, it was also Carla Del Ponte at the United Nations
indeed,
that was saying
indeed.
That.
And I wonder how many Labour MPs know who Seymour Hersh is, because he was the man who exposed the My Lai massacre. He's got a reputation in US journalistic circles of never getting anything wrong, because his sources are so impeccable. And have they read his article, and do they understand the implications? Now, in actual fact, therefore, what should have happened after it became clear that the Ghouta chemical weapons attack was actually carried out by NATO-allied Turkey, working with the al-Nusra Front and the Saudis, is that we should have declared war on Turkey and Saudi Arabia. But we didn't, did we? Because they're our allies. And I'm in favour of declaring war on Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Maybe Putin should do it. Maybe he will.
Jim from Bristol Stop the War. What about this other side of this mission creep business, where we could actually start to get involved in a war for Syria rather than just in Syria against ISIS?
Well, they've already said that they're in here for the long haul. Now, their original strategy doesn't look very good. The Americans have said they're going to put in ground troops if they need to. It does look like mission creep is on the cards. And there's talk today about salami slicing. Cameron will put in a bombing mission that will prepare the way for his ground troops to go in and will be involved in a massive attack on Syria, as you point out, repeating all the mistakes that we've already had in Iraq and other countries. It really isn't. It's almost beyond belief that this is the fourth war in 14 years that we're expected to support. And that's why we're calling for all these demonstrations. People have got to say this is enough. Britain has better things to do internationally than become a tail following the dog of US imperialism. It's got to say we believe in negotiation, economic support. They should be supporting the refugees in this country. All the migrants should be getting somewhere to live. They should be doing something humanitarian, something we can hold our heads up about, not bombing people.
Well, it's easy to say the migrants should all get somewhere to live, but even British people don't have somewhere to live.
Precisely. It clashes with this ludicrous austerity programme, but these all have got to go if we want to be a country worth living in.
Now let's go back to what I was talking about at the top of the hour, which is this amazing plan the neocons had, the project for the new American century. As soon as 9/11 had happened in 2001, this whole idea of these long wars really started to roll out across the world, where the US was basically saying, well, we can invade wherever we want to. And one of the brilliant documentaries done, actually amazingly enough, by the BBC Panorama at the time was called The War Party, where they went and had a chat to a lot of these neocons. And let's start by having a listen to what James Woolsey said from the CIA.
We will make a lot of people very nervous. And we will hear, for example, the Mubarak regime in Egypt or the Saudi royal family thinking about this idea that these Americans are spreading a democracy in this part of the world. They will say, you make us very nervous. And our response should be good.
Going too far?
No. The Iranians and the Syrians are even more nervous than the Saudis and Egyptians at this very moment. Syria is making, the Syrian regime is making comments that they're nervous, that they think that they're next.
So, are the Syrians worried? I went to their embassy to ask whether they took much notice of the neoconservatives. Do they go to those American Enterprise Institute briefings?
Oh, yes, I try to attend almost all their public meetings. Sometimes I find them amusing. Sometimes they are really terrifying in the way they think, the way they would like to shape the world, the way they think they can impose their doctrine and their ideology on everybody else, even if force is needed.
You worried?
No, we are not worried at all. We have our alliances, we have our friends, but I don't think they have any chance whatsoever of translating this agenda into policies.
Well, they apparently they do now. Martin, that was the deputy ambassador in Washington, the Syrian embassy, and before him you heard James Woolsey from the CIA and Mehrav Wormser from the Hudson Institute. Now this is all coming to pass. There was the Syrians there saying, no, we're not nervous at all.
Well, I think what's actually happened is because of the Russian intervention in Syria, it's quite clear. I mean, the Russians are basically saying, and Assad is basically saying, we can have this war over probably in 2016. If we cut off the supplies to ISIS and we isolate the pockets of the other rebels, many of whom are foreigners, and they say that we're getting good targeting information from on the ground from Syrians, because a lot of the people that are fighting inside Syria are not, in fact, Syrians, and that they're winning the war. Now, at that point, it becomes really embarrassing for the West. They've got to, they had to come up with something, because they failed to convince everybody about the chemical weapons attack. And of course, it's not just that Assad didn't do it. What people have got to take on board is that NATO did do it. MIT in Turkey were behind that chemical weapons attack, which killed hundreds of people. Now, at some point, you've got to say, what should we do? Like Hillary Benn was saying on Wednesday, what should we do? Hundreds of people have been killed by a chemical weapons attack, but it wasn't Assad, it was carried out by Erdogan, who's just been re-elected as president of Turkey. Not that the Kurds are very happy about that. Maybe we should break up his state. Maybe we should take up arms. I'm not a pacifist. Maybe it's about time we started killing these people. What do you think?
Well, let's go back to the post 9/11, immediate post 9/11 era, and 2003, and the invasion of Iraq. And here a little clip from a certain prime minister of the time.
The justice of our cause lies in the liberation of the Iraqi people. And to them we say, we will liberate you.
Tony Blair there saying he's going to liberate the Iraqi people, exactly the same, I suppose, as we're hearing now from David Cameron talking about Syria.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the elected Iraqi government has accused Britain of dropping weaponry to ISIS. They've already done it. Not that you've heard about it in the mainstream media here in Britain.
Now let's go back to that same part of that same documentary, Panorama, The War Party, looking at the neocons. And let's have a listen to a chap called Elliot Cohen. He's on the US Defense Policy Board.
Sometimes the word neoconservative is used when what they really would like to say is Jew. People who use that kind of language. And as a Jew, I find it offensive. There are two things that are despicable about it. The first is the imputation of dual loyalties.
Between America and Israel.
Right. And just speaking as somebody whose father served in the United States Army, who served in the United States Army himself, who was the son serving in the United States Army, I find it deeply, deeply offensive and untrue. And the other thing that I find deeply offensive about it is it contains a very old anti-Semitic canard, which is that the Jews, this scattered little people around the world, have these occult powers and are pulling the strings of the naive and duped non-Jews. And it wasn't that long ago that those kinds of beliefs led to hideous things, which impinged upon people like me very directly. So yes, I feel very strongly about it.
Well, one might actually say, well, why shouldn't Elliot Cohen have dual loyalties between Israel and the United States, Martin? Because at least Israel is pretty much the only democracy in the Middle East.
Apart from if you're Palestinian. Well, I'd just like to mention Lieutenant Colonel Alan Sobrowski, former head of the Director of Studies at the U.S. Army War College, and Jewish. He's made it absolutely clear, and people can check this, they can just look it up online, he thinks the Israeli Mossad were behind the 9/11 attacks on the U.S. He was a serving U.S. Army officer, a very senior guy, also Jewish, quite straightforward, his loyalties don't lie with Israel, his loyalties lie to the United States, and he's accused Israel of being behind the attacks.
Well, let's hear the final extract from that documentary from Panorama, The War Party. Fascinating insight into the neoconservatives and how all this kind of idea of perpetual war, Middle Eastern wars, and really prepared the groundwork for the invasion of Iraq back in 2003. And here again now from Mayrav Wormser, who's one of the neocons. She is actually from the Hudson Institute. We heard a little clip earlier. Here's another one.
Yes, many of us are Jewish. There's no need to apologize for that. Most of us, all of us, in fact, are pro-Israel. Some of us more fiercely so than others. But we have no problem also criticizing Israel. There is no dual loyalty. The people in the group are Americans, first and foremost. View themselves as American thinkers and as people who are most interested in American policy. We see a tremendous similarity between Israel and America, and Britain for that matter, simply because these are leading democracies. In the case of Israel, it's the only democracy in the Middle East.
As you said there, Jim, the only democracy in the Middle East.
Well, Israel isn't a proper democracy, is it? It's a limited democracy based on religion and ethnicity. It, as Martin pointed out, avoiding the thorny question of the Palestinians and Israeli Arabs, who are not treated as equal citizens. So it's a very dubious bit of triumphalism to say Israel's the only democracy, is it?
I mean, also Israel does have an interest in Syria. They've got the Golan Heights they've been occupying since 1967, a very, very long time ago. The Six-Day War, I think it was. Is it, Martin? Is that right? The Six-Day War?
The 73 War.
That the Golan Heights were occupied, and most of the Palestinian territories were taken over in the 67 War. It's never been resolved through the United Nations. They've had many resolutions telling them not to go. But anyway, the most important thing is that they're now drilling for oil, and they're selling oil concessions in the Golan Heights, which is actually part of Syria.
Well, exactly.
It's almost like maybe a state of the USA, Israel, over there.
That's possible. The fact of the matter is, however, in general, that the West is not going to solve this by its present strategy. It's going to just lead to further wars, this likelihood of actually sparking off, as Martin pointed out, a conflict with Russia, in which case we have started the Third World War. And I think that we're looking at a run-up to an extremely dangerous period, and I think that's why British people, at least half of them, are against any British intervention in this area. As the Iraqi government has said, and the Syrian government, they don't want us there. We've caused enough damage, enough misery, millions of people killed. Can't we just go away and think of something better to do?
Martin, Israel almost seems to have taken a back seat with Syria, even though it's right next door.
Not true. Many people believe that the ISIS is in fact part of Mossad's intelligence operation. The Iraqis claim to have captured an Israeli colonel operating with ISIS inside Iraq. Again, this is not the sort of thing that the mainstream media in the West is reporting, even though it's been reported in Baghdad. And we had the Tory MP from Baghdad earlier talking. Does he know what the press in Baghdad are saying? Al-Baghdadi was seen photographed twice at least with John McCain inside Syria, and is also widely reputed in Iraq and in Lebanon and other places where serious people read serious newspapers to have been trained by the Mossad. And of course also there's overwhelming evidence that ISIS fighters and other al-Nusra Front fighters have been taken into Syria for medical treatment and then shipped back into Syria to fight the Assad regime, and some of them were actually attacked by local Druze in the Golan Heights, and then the Israeli army then took on the Druze to protect the terrorists who were being put back inside Syria. So from the Syrian point of view, it's pretty clear that what they're up against is an armed conspiracy of mostly foreigners being supported, armed and trained, by MIT in Turkey, Mossad in Israel, and CIA, MI6,
desembureau the French.
And so do you think the Russians who are backing Assad with Assad are going to eventually come to blows with NATO, Britain and the US?
Well, it's interesting. None of the MPs talked about that in that discussion, because if you get to a situation where we are trying to overthrow Assad, that's why the Russians are being very calm about our intervention. They're saying, listen, if you want to go and drop a few bombs on Raqqa, off you go, and we won't do anything about it. But if it comes to a showdown between our forces and Turkey's forces, for example, as we try to close down ISIS's supply lines from Turkey, if the RAF happen to be straying into our airspace at that point, and we at any point can say, you are not to fly in this airspace. The Syrian government and the Russians have taken a very kind of ambiguous stance. What they've said is, we don't want you overflying our airspace, we're not really in favour of you being here, but as long as you're not attacking our positions, we won't do anything. But if they do try and use them to support the moderate rebels, for example, so-called moderate rebels, they will be going directly against the Syrian Arab army, which has taken 60,000 casualties fighting these terrorists, and they'll also be taking on the Russian Air Force. And I think that the Tornado bombers that the British were deploying earlier in the week are basically junk from 30 years ago, and if they try and take on the modern Russian Air Force, all four of our planes are going to be shot down, and perhaps the pilots captured, and then what?
I'll tell you what, also today we've had German MPs voting for an anti-ISIS military mission, including boots on the ground. The Germans and the Japanese now have said that it's okay for their troops to fight outside. Over the last few years, both countries have voted for that, and the Germans are going to be putting boots on the ground, although they say they're not going to be directly involved in conflict.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the only legal basis for anybody to go into Syria is either a UN Security Council resolution, and what's been passed so far does not.
Well, look,
cover
let
it.
Me just stop you there, because the UN approved Syria resolution. I'm just going to grab the date for that. That's on the 21st of November. Member states were urged to take all necessary measures, but the resolution, let's make it absolutely clear, falls short of invoking Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which authorises military action to restore
That's
peace
right.
and security.
So in other words, that the UN resolution as been agreed by the Russians does not give the right to military action, and the only basis on which you can on a legal basis go into Syria is if you are working directly with the legitimate government of Syria, that is to say the Assad regime. So all of these countries can vote in their parliaments to send, the Germans and the Japanese can vote to send their soldiers to fight in Syria.
Yeah, well, Cameron,
it doesn't make it
Cameron,
legal.
Yeah, but hang on, Cameron says yes it does, because he's acting in self-defence.
No, he's wrong. There is no basis. I've been reading legal judgments by people who are serious lawyers saying there's no... The reason why the Russians agreed that wording for that resolution is because it definitely does not give the right to military intervention.
So why are the Russians saying great and they're not making more of a fuss about this?
Because politically, what the Russians are trying to do is play... all right, well, it'd be unreasonable of us to shoot your planes down, which it would. We're not going to shoot your planes down. And they're also trying to play to get public opinion
on
their side.
If the Russians ever want to invoke international law, surely they could say what you've done has just broken international law.
Well,
and they wouldn't have to shoot any planes down.
Well, what they've done a deal with NATO, which was broken by the Turks, that they will supply NATO with the full details of what all their planes are doing. And they've done that. And they've said the same to NATO. You tell us where your planes are as well, and we'll make sure that we don't come into any kind of conflict with you. That's the deal. But, of course, the Turks, quite deliberately and with American approval, shot down a Russian plane. Now, the Russians, rather than overreacting, they're very clever, are just saying, right, we note that. We note what you've just done. We presume that that was agreed with the Americans. We know it was an ambush and it wasn't an accident. But we're not going to do anything for now. As the Aussies say, you'll keep, mate, you'll keep.
Well, we'll see about that. One of the key elements of all this, of course, is the Israeli involvement with ISIS. We were hearing from John Banks last week about that, for example, helping to train the leader of ISIS. And so let's have a listen now to Stephen Sizer talking about the roots of Israel, for the roots of political Israel, really, that is, roots of Zionism. Now, Stephen Sizer is a reverend in Virginia Water in the Church of England in southwest London. And here he is doing a talk, but he's He's not allowed to do talks anymore because he's been banned by the church from doing any more. So let's have a listen to a recording of him talking about Zionism, literally about 6 or 8 months before he was banned from speaking in public by the Church of England.
I discovered that I had inherited a script that viewed the Jews as God's chosen people and the Palestinians were a problem. They were the Philistines. They were the enemy of God's people, and therefore I was nervous about meeting with them. We avoided them. You know, we went to the holy sites, we took our photographs, we read our Bible, we had our religious experience, and we were just a little frustrated that, you know, the Palestinians were in the way of God's will being realized for the Jewish people. And but I went back a second time and a third time and a fourth time, and every time I went back, a little bit more of that romantic vision dissipated, and I began to get to know Palestinian Christians. I'd been brought up to believe all Palestinians were Muslims. The problem was between the Jews and the Muslims. But to discover a Christian, an indigenous Christian Palestinian community, was a revelation. That they'd been there for 2,000 years, that they were suffering as a result of Zionism, and they were suffering largely because the church in the West sided with Israel against the Palestinians. And I began to be troubled by that.
That's Reverend Stephen Sizer. Martin, can you sum up in a nutshell what Zionism is? Because it's a very powerful, in fact, some would say fundamentalist approach that a lot of Israelis have.
Well, Zionism was a product of the sort of late 19th century, early 20th century, and it was probably, you could compare it to Irish republicanism. It was that at that time, everybody all over the world was developing nationalistic ideas. And the difference, of course, being that in Ireland they were trying to recapture the historic state of Ireland, which of course had never existed apart from as an imaginary goal. And the same was true of Zionism, which was an attempt to create a nationalism for the Jews, revolving around the state of what is now Israel, where most Jews didn't live, which is what made it unique. But you could compare it again with the sort of nationalism of the Afrikaners in South Africa, who call themselves Afrikaners. They're originally from Holland, but they regarded the Africa as their God-given territory that they were allowed to have. I mean, it looks out of time now. These kind of nationalistic ideas in the 21st century look kind of dated. But Zionism was a product of that era, with all of the positive and negative features that you might imagine.
And what about this idea of Balkanization of the Middle East? Well, that's part of this Yinon plan, isn't it? General Oded Yinon.
The Yinon plan.
I think
plan.
Wasn't it even in the 1960s, late 60s, he came up with this idea that the best thing to do would be to Balkanize the Middle East and then Israel could expand.
Well, yes, yeah, Israel could expand, but also, of course, if you've got lots of ethnic states surrounding you, the ethnic basis of your own state becomes unremarkable. We've got a Kurdish state over here, we've got a Druze state over here, we've got an Alawite state over here, and we've got a Jewish state over here, and then Israel fits in to the general pattern. But of course, that, you know, in the 19th century, people believed if everybody got their own little state, then everything would be fine. But of course, the problem is that my little state treads on the toes of your little state, as we saw in Yugoslavia, or as we see today in India, or anywhere else in the world. In actual fact, my nationalism is a way of stopping you having your nationalism. So it's actually potentially a recipe for chaos. And I'm afraid that's what we've got.
And Stephen Sizer, the Reverend Stephen Sizer, also sees the Zionism as a kind of form of fundamentalism. We hear lots and lots about Islamic fundamentalism, but very little about Zionist fundamentalism.
There's a very clear, very simple political strategy. The first is, if you believe that the Jews are God's chosen people, you will support the Jews. You will defend Israel. You will target those critical of Israel. So you campaign politically in the White House, the Senate, Congress, Parliament, on behalf of Israel. If you believe that the Jews are God's chosen people and that God gave them the land of the Middle East, then you will support their return. You will fund the return of Jews from Russia, for example, to Israel. If you believe God gave the Jews the West Bank, the Golan, Jordan, then you will encourage the settlement movement. So you have Christian organizations that encourage churches to adopt a settlement, to fund a settlement, a Jewish settlement in the occupied territories. At the moment, the only country in the world that recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel is Israel. No other country in the world recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. There are no embassies in Jerusalem. All the embassies are in Tel Aviv. There is one embassy in Jerusalem, the Christian embassy. And so there is a campaign to get the United States to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. How do you do that? You simply move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And if the U.S. moves its embassy to Jerusalem, everyone else will do the same. And de facto, Jerusalem becomes capital. So there are Christian organizations lobbying Congress to move the embassy to Jerusalem. The legislation has been passed on at least three occasions. The funding has been allocated. The building has been identified. But three successive presidents have refused to sign the legislation. So it's failed. The Zionist lobby, the religious Zionist lobby, wants to see the temple rebuilt. The problem is the Haram al-Sharif, the Dome of the Rock, is in the way. And so you find Christian groups campaigning with Jewish settlers to destroy the Dome of the Rock in order to rebuild the Jewish temple. So in its extreme form, Christian Zionism is very provocative. It is apocalyptic. It is very fundamentalist in a military sense. Very little different to ISIS or Al-Qaeda in terms of what it's prepared to support.
Well, that's obviously about Christian Zionists rather than Zionists as such. But paradoxically enough, of course, there is a massive alliance emerging between Saudi Arabia, the biggest fundamentalist Muslim state in the world, and Israel, which has got a fundamentalist religious orientation to its government, to crush secular states like Syria and balkanize them upon religious and ethnic lines, as we're seeing. And the paradoxes of this are just getting more and more ridiculous, but I think it's absolutely clear that is what's developing.
Another thing, Stephen Sizer, a final clip from him now, talks about is this kind of idea of doom porn, that a lot of them are talking about doom and gloom over there. That is, there's going to be some sort of apocalyptic clash between Islam and the Jews.
In every generation, for hundreds if not thousands of years, there have been people who held to an apocalyptic theology. So it's not something new, that extremism that believes that they will bring about God's will through violence or through force is sadly an aberration in all three monotheistic faiths. One of the leading Jewish settlers, Zionists, Gershon Salomon, says we must have a war. The Messiah will not come by himself. We must bring him by fighting. Now, that was the position of the Zealots in the first century. They believed that as they fought, God would vindicate them. It's not that dissimilar to many of the fundamentalist groups in the Middle East today. They believe God is on their side rather than asking, am I on God's side? Am I following his revealed will in the scriptures? Or am I using God as an excuse to further my political aims?
Using God as an excuse to further my political aims sounds a little bit like ISIS, doesn't it?
It does, and of course ISIS in many ways is a creation of Orientalist minds within the Western intelligence services. So people can look it up. ISIS have got a monthly magazine which has lots of lovely colour pictures. It's like
I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put a link
Vogue,
to it. Martin, we'll put a link to it on the show page at thisweek.org.uk, because it's quite an astounding magazine.
Yes, and it's clearly been written by US PR professionals in English.
There is a material base to all this, surely. The Western capitalism faces massive crisis. It's very hard for them to get out of it. Look at Japan. It's been in recession for like decades. So millenarianism, let's have a cataclysm, fits in with Western capitalism's need to clear the air, let's have a massive war. This is extremely disturbing, though, because this... we know what the Second World War was like, but the Third World War is unimaginably bad. And I think we're dealing with lunacy, really. And what Stop the War is asking is that people, the British public, aren't mad. That enough people have regained logic and sanity to call their rulers to question and say, do you really want this cataclysm? And I think that's what we're told, why we're asking people to come to London next, not this Saturday coming, but the Saturday after.
Martin, what about the that we're now in? We are now, I go back to this point, we're now actually in Syria fighting where the Russians are fighting too. It's quite feasible that we could disagree about things.
Well, I think I'm reasonably calm about the situation at the minute because they don't really dare to take on the Syrian Arab Army, who've actually got very good fighting in the last 4 years, and the Russian Air Force. If they do attempt to try and overthrow Assad or partition Syria, then it'll get to the point where the RAF will have to take on the Russian Air Force. The RAF will lose.
Very briefly, San Bernardino shootings, what do we know? Well, again, it looks as if the people are dead, Martin, the people who did it, so no trials.
Well, it's again, these kind of shocking events are being used, in my view, they're Gladio-style events to try and scare the population to accept more loss of liberties.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest in the first hour for St George West Labour, Ron Stone. Our sister show Dialect's been dropped from the BCFM schedule by the chair and the manager, but it's still available as a podcast. You can hear last week's special on the withdrawal of funding from St Paul's Carnival, from Carnival director Cleo Lake, also the Medieval Knights Templar, and the Merchant Venturers, St Paul poet Lawrence Hu, challenges Bristol's official history. You can download this podcast and read those links at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
CFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.